This morning, we're returning to an unusual passage in the book of Ecclesiastes, and that is chapter 10. We started in there last week, so I'd like to invite you to return to Ecclesiastes chapter 10. And my goal this morning would be to bring out the truth of verses 4 through 11 that the Lord has for us here, Ecclesiastes 10, 4 through 11. A few years ago, on a very cold winter day, I found myself in Timbuktu, between here and the North Carolina border. And I was there because one of our sons, who likes to off-road, and who's not here so I can talk about him, he got himself majorly stuck out in the middle of nowhere. And I was not happy. And it actually took two or three trips and a variety of efforts to get him out of this field where he was stuck. And I was not thinking straight as I was working with all of that. And one of the things I tried was to use our little station wagon to pull him out, only to get it stuck as well. And looking back, it's kind of a funny memory. At the time, it wasn't, but it kind of leads me to something of what is going on in this text as I think back on that and how we had to first get my car towed out of there and then his truck as well. You can make a problem worse by using an unwise method to resolve it. And that is something of the flavor of what we're going to encounter here in this passage. We want to remember what Solomon had been talking about there at the end of chapter 9. He made it very clear to us there and in other places in this book of how uncertain life is and how there are so many things that come upon us that we cannot expect, that we cannot predict, that we really don't think are fair in many cases. Nothing's going to change that about life. We have to figure out what would be the best way to deal with those kinds of circumstances. Life in a fallen world is uncertain. And even though wisdom isn't going to resolve all of those problems, it continues to be the best way to make your way through life. It is still the best option for living life. Or to put it in the vernacular, life is rough enough without any help from you. Don't make it worse by being an idiot. That is what Solomon taught there at the end of Ecclesiastes chapter 9, and that is what he's now developing throughout chapter 10. And as we saw last week, at the beginning of chapter 10, he begins with a brief expose of folly. And that which we are to avoid as we strive to make our way through this uncertain world. Those statements in verses 1 to 3 were urging us to avoid folly and to pursue wisdom. We were taught that if we want to make the best possible use of earthly life, we're going to have to resist the tendency to follow our feelings and impulses and do things without thinking carefully. On the other hand, we cannot expect to find some neat formula that is going to spell out what we are supposed to do in every situation. You know, life is so complicated, it is so messy at times, that there just aren't going to be enough rules available to resolve every possible contingency that we might face. There are just endless possibilities of problems and complications. And there is no way that we could anticipate everything and have some kind of nice formula ahead of time. What we're going to do, what we're going to need to do, is to develop a kind of a sixth sense, a capacity to make sound judgment calls in particular circumstances that we run across, the ability to take general biblical principles and to apply them to the specifics of our individual lives. And that skill, that capacity, that sixth sense, or whatever you want to call it, is what the Bible calls wisdom. That is what the rest of this chapter is talking to us about. Last time we were focused mostly on the negative and the avoidance of folly. As we go forward in this passage, it's going to be more positive, and it's encouragement to us that we might pursue wisdom. And so the title of the message this morning and next time is Pursue Wisdom. I say next time because there are several topics that are going to be discussed here under that general theme. This morning we're just looking at two of the areas where we're going to need wisdom. Pursue wisdom. The first of those areas is going to be laid out for us in verses 4 to 7. I'll go ahead and read this passage. Ecclesiastes 10, starting at verse 4. If the anger of the ruler rises against you, do not leave your place, for calmness will lay great offenses to rest. There is an evil that I have seen under the sun, as it were an error proceeding from the ruler. Folly is set in many high places, and the rich sit in a low place. I have seen slaves on horses and princes walking on the ground like slaves. This is an unusual portion of Scripture. That's kind of an unusual little text there, and it makes this point. Pursue wisdom in responding to authorities. Pursue wisdom in responding to the authorities that are in your life. That is clear as you look again at verse 4. It says, if the anger of the ruler rises against you, do not leave your place, for calmness will lay great offenses to rest. Clearly, he's talking about the ruler, some kind of political authority. Actually, that area of life comes up several times in this context, so much so that some commentators think that the entire chapter relates in some way to political authorities. And that would naturally be an area of focus for Solomon, since he was a king, a powerful, a wise king with wide experience in dealing with people, and since he also would have interacted with a lot of other kings from that part of the world. And that verse, verse 4, envisions situations that a person could find himself in where the ruler is angry with the individual. Perhaps it's a member of his court. You put yourself in this person's shoes. Maybe you had achieved some kind of close relationship with the ruler. Maybe up to that point he had really looked to you for counsel and had given you great responsibility. And something happens and he is mad. Why is he mad? Why is he angry? The passage doesn't really say. The anger could be entirely the ruler's fault. And we have in the Bible and throughout history plenty of stories of kings being irrational and kings being petty and lashing out rashly at their subjects and abusing the position that they have and using it purely for their own selfish gain instead of for the good of the people under them. And so it wouldn't be a surprise if this king were angry at this person just because that's what he did. He's an angry, unreasonable person. Or it may be that in this case, the subject, that the person who receives the anger, has done something inappropriate, has done something out of line, has violated the trust of the king, or made some major blunder that causes the ruler to be angry. Either way, whether it's just the king's own fault or whether it's somehow your fault, the counsel, the wisdom here that you're receiving, the wise response that is being encouraged, it really is the same. And the verse goes on to give you its counsel in a negative and then in a positive. In a negative, it says, do not leave your place. If the anger of the ruler rises against you, do not leave your place. Why would you be tempted to leave your place in a moment like that? Well, again, think back at whose fault this all may be. If it is purely a matter of the ruler's harshness and the ruler's anger himself, you might be tempted to storm out of there in frustration, maybe even resign whatever your position would be, give up on it all, throw up your hands in despair and disgust, and have a kind of a revolt about your spirit, kind of a revolutionary sort of a spirit. You might be tempted, particularly if it was just his fault, to storm out of there and leave all of that behind and maybe find ways yourself to lash out at the authority. Or if it somehow was your fault, you might be tempted to run away in fear. And you're afraid that something serious is coming. You're afraid of punishment. And again, no matter what would be your thinking and why you might be tempted to leave your place, Solomon's advice is the same either way, and he says, don't run away. That would be foolish. You say, why? And what is the positive part of this? The positive part comes in terms of the reason the verse goes on to give as to why you ought to stay in your place. And he says, for calmness will lay great offenses to rest. Calmness will lay great offenses to rest. And once again, whose offenses? They could be those of the ruler who's angry with you. They could be your own offenses that somehow need to be dealt with so that you are in good relationship with the ruler. Either way, the principle is calmness is going to lay those great offenses to rest. That's going to be the general result of having this calm response. And there's an interesting little wordplay here in that the words translated to leave, that is, don't leave, is from the same root as the word translated lay to rest. They have to do with calmness and things settling down. In other words, don't leave, as in don't rush off, just kind of calm down yourself. And the effect of that is going to be that more than likely the situation will calm down. If you don't leave, you may be able to cause the offense to leave, would be a way to reflect the wordplay there. The key word, though, is the word calmness itself. And it is from a root that has to do with healing. And here it refers to maintaining your composure and having a kind of a healing effect in that you are responding in a gentle and in a soothing way toward this angry authority in your life. In fact, it is translated gentle in Proverbs 15:4, where Solomon writes, a gentle tongue is a tree of life. A gentle tongue is a tree of life. A little different word, but the same idea in a verse I quoted recently, Proverbs 18:2, same concept. A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. He's applying that principle to interacting with an authority who is angry with you and who might even be abusing his power. And he says, a gentle tongue, have a healing, a soothing influence in that situation. And as we go on in verses 5 to 7, the next few verses here, they're going to bring up the problem, one of the problems that often characterizes rulers, one of the challenging situations you might find yourself in with a ruler that makes it all the more important to develop that sort of response to them, to be careful about what you're saying, to be guarding what comes out of your mouth and the attitude that you're conveying. Here is one of the sad realities of how it often works when you're dealing with political authorities. He says in verse 5, there is an evil that I have seen under the sun, as it were an error proceeding from the ruler. Folly is set in many high places. Actually, even if somehow you're partially responsible for that anger, the sad truth is that very often, the person that you are dealing with, the person in authority, is a fool. This should not be surprising to us when we have political leaders that, biblically speaking, could be classified as fools in terms of their lifestyle, in terms of their decision-making, in terms of their policies, in terms of their response to pressure, in terms of their dealings, with situations that come up. This book is very blunt with us about that sort of thing. Often, folly is set in high places. That's just the way it is in a broken world, and often there's nothing that you and I can do to stop that. And then he says that the rich sit in a low place. Rich there, those individuals aren't necessarily being elevated as somehow more worthy, but it is picking up on a general pattern. That people who have developed the skill to manage money and to make money, they tend to have solid, sound, earthly wisdom that serves them well when they are in positions of authority. And then he says, I have seen slaves on horses. And in that culture, I don't know, you could think of a horse in terms of a limousine. Perhaps in our culture it was a symbol of somebody in a position of nobility and of wealth and of influence in society. And the person that is riding the horse in this case is a slave, somebody who is very low in the social stratum and who really has little competency for the job that they have been given to do in a position of authority. And on the other hand, the princes, the ones who have that sort of background and skill, they are walking on the ground like as if they were slaves. And it's a total reversal of what you would normally expect and of what normally would seem to make for good government. The wrong sorts of people, the unwise, the fools, are the ones in authority. And Solomon is very forthright about that. Political leadership often is unqualified. And our world is often one where might is what makes right. The implication is that you probably won't be able to do anything to change that situation, and that at a certain point, resisting those kinds of leaders is only going to make matters worse for you. It is going to be the sort of response that aggravates the situation. If you can't do anything to change the situation, the wise response is to accept it as a reality and to do your best to work with it with the kind of gracious, calm, soothing, careful, cautious sort of response instead of loudness and blowing up and protesting and crying out. There's a real carefulness when you're in a situation like that. That's what's going to be the thing that is most likely to help. And I think of biblical examples like Daniel, who found himself in the court of a fool, Nebuchadnezzar, who was such a fool that God had to humble him by making him eat grass for 7 years. And yet, what is Daniel's approach? Even in areas where his conscience was really troubled, he finds a way to carefully, graciously work within that context. And he actually ends up, in many ways, supporting and helping and moving forward this very wicked government. Because that's the place where God had him to serve and to strive to be an influence for that which was good and right. And yet on a personal level, as he's interacting, he is Ecclesiastes 10. He is a man who is calmly dealing with the situation, graciously working with what he has been given in order to promote wisdom. You can think of other examples. I think of Esther, Queen Esther, and her unusual role as well. Pursue wisdom in responding to authorities. Now, how would we apply that principle to our lives? We today do not live in a monarchy. We have more opportunities to advance good causes and even biblical causes in our society. We have greater freedoms and aren't perhaps as bothered and as abused as these people would have been. However, our culture is becoming increasingly secular and increasingly hostile to biblical values, and our rights often are diminished. And I think that what Solomon is saying here is going to become all the more necessary for the people of God. You know, we as Americans, and I have touched on this briefly before, but we're kind of in a point of tension when it comes to some of these things. Because there is something about the American concept of rights that is a biblically based idea that is rooted in the image of God in man, whether or not our leaders, all of them originally did hold to that or do now, there really is something about the biblical worldview that would support the concept of civil rights, which would include things like freedom of speech and freedom of worship and so forth. And yet sometimes the way that Christian people even stand up for those rights in our culture, it ends up conflicting with other biblical principles. In fact, the Bible itself tells us to expect that there are going to be many times for the people of God where your rights are not going to be respected. That the world is ruled, generally speaking, by wicked people. That your authorities are going to resist you and they're going to persecute you, specifically for your faith in Christ and your worship of Him. So on the one hand, if we have opportunity, we want to promote human rights and freedoms. On the other hand, we recognize this is a fallen world, and often that's just not going to happen. So what do you do? Well, I think Ecclesiastes guides us there, and I think the New Testament as well. I'd like to have you go to a parallel passage over in 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2, I just want to read for us a section here at the end of this chapter that brings us all together from a New Testament standpoint. Starting in verse 13, 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 13, these are the words of the Lord. Be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor as supreme. Listen to that. None of us have ever had to live, I don't think, under that level of authority. To the emperor as supreme. Or to governors as sent by him to punish those who do evil and to praise those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. At a certain point, this has got to be our guiding principle for how we interact with our authorities. My focus is going to be on doing good, on representing the Lord in a Christ-like way, of promoting the good of my society and my community. And it is through that, not through my revolutionary spirit, not through my loudness and in-your-faceness, through my doing good that I'm going to impress onlookers with what makes us different and what ultimately exonerates us as believers, put to silence their ignorance. Live as people who are free, but not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. Honor everyone, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the emperor. And then, talking about abuse of authorities, he's going to go on and address the slaves. Servants, be subject to your masters with all respect, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the unjust. For this is a gracious thing, when mindful of God, one endures sorrows while suffering unjustly. For what credit is it if when you sin and are beaten for it, you endure? But if when you do good and suffer for it, you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. For to this you have been called. And now it really comes to a head. Because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example so that you might follow in his steps. He committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree, that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. By his wounds you have been healed, for you were straying like sheep, but have now returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. What a wonderful gospel conclusion to all of that. And the point is that our gospel, what we believe to as the core of our faith and the thing that has saved us and reconciled us to God, or that will do the same for you if you trust in this Jesus, what is it all about? Really is a part of how that all happened historically, there was a man, God in the flesh, who took this very same attitude when he was under pressure from his authorities. He did not revolt. He was calm. He was gracious. He was patient. He was entrusting himself to God to deal with the injustice instead of trying to take matters into his own hands. And that's why we're saved in a very real sense. It was that spirit of calmness and peace that resulted in our very salvation that brought us to the Lord and to experience his ministry as our shepherd. Pursue wisdom that way in responding to your authorities. However, I don't think we ought to limit this application merely to our political authorities. And I would just throw out this question: what would this kind of attitude look like? This kind of wisdom look like? What would it look like for other sorts of tensions with authorities? What about a wife who finds herself in tension with her husband? Or children who find themselves in tension with their parents? Church members who are in tension with their leadership? An employee in conflict with his employer? A student with those who are in authority over him at school? Or even something minor, we would say, like a player and the coach of his team? How do you interact with those who are over you, with those who may be angry with you, with those whose anger may be unjustified? Folks, all of us are under some kind of authority, and most of us are under several levels of authority. And all of our authorities are sinners. And we are sinners too. And stuff is going to happen. And there will be tensions. It is unavoidable. It is inevitable that they arise. And a passage like this is instructing us on how to help the situation instead of making it worse. Calmness is what makes for resolution. And basically, the answer is gentleness and self-control. It struck me in thinking about this that those two words go together in Paul's list of the fruit of the Spirit. The last two are gentleness and self-control. That would be a new covenant way of saying the principle of this verse. Yield yourself to the influence of the Spirit who has taken up residence within you. Yield yourself to his enabling power. Call out to him for the grace that you need to be able to respond with that kind of gentleness and self-control. And his ministry is going to be required as well as we begin to apply to our lives the second piece of wisdom that Solomon gives us here. First of all, he said, pursue wisdom in responding to authorities. And now he's going to say, pursue wisdom in responding to dangers that we face in life. And I think the application is wide open to all kinds of risks and potential dangers. Remember how I've kept saying throughout this that there are no guarantees in life, that we live in a cursed world and sin has an effect on our circumstances and on our surroundings, and we cannot count on anything material or human to hold up and do everything we expect. And that reality comes into special focus here with four interesting illustrations. One of the things I want to point out here is that as you read our version, the ESV, the verbs in these statements read in the future. Like verse 8 says, he who digs a pit will fall into it. That is a possible way to translate it, but I would find it difficult to understand exactly what that would mean unless you just take it in a very general sense that this sort of thing does happen. It's not really saying it's always going to happen, which is what probably most people would infer from that statement. He who digs a pit will fall into it. A serpent will bite him, and so forth. It really doesn't always happen. It's not, you're not always dealing with the worst case scenario. And the other way to translate this is what we refer to as a modal, which would indicate the possibility that these things could happen or may happen. And so I want to read it along those lines. A number of versions put it that way. This is the New American Standard Bible. It says, "He who digs a pit may fall into it." In other words, that's one of the things that could happen. That's a possibility. "And a serpent may bite him who breaks through a wall. He who quarries stones may be hurt by them. And he who splits logs may be endangered by them." You think back on that little list of four actions that a person is carrying out. None of these actions suggest to me something wrong that the individual is doing, something morally or ethically wrong. These are relatively commonplace activities in the ancient world. And the first two would have a pretty obvious component of danger to them. Digging a pit, maybe to use as a trap to capture an animal that you're hunting down. Well, you can just imagine that you could easily not be paying attention and slip and fall, or somebody push you into this hole that you dug for an animal. That may happen. You know that danger going into it. Or if you're breaking through a wall, and you don't want to think of walls of their homes as nice and smooth and sort of sterile like ours might be. You're talking about these rough-hewn rocks and all of this mud that's packed in there and all these crevices, and it would be very natural for some animal, some creature, some snake to hide in there, and so here you are tearing it down, and all of a sudden a snake comes out and bites you. The other two actions are not quite as dangerous on the surface, maybe, but quarrying stones, which is more of a profession, people cutting off huge pieces of rock off the side of a mountain or something. But certainly there would be an element of danger there if you're not being careful. No doubt these people had their procedures and their ways of being safe, but again, anything could happen. Or something as basic as splitting a log. Something could happen, and you might be endangered by them. I don't know. Maybe a piece of the log comes flying back in your face or lands on your foot, or the axe head falls off and smacks you in the head. I mean, think about your own life. Something as simple as hammering a nail. What could go wrong? And how many of us have smashed our fingers doing something so simple? The point is that just out in life, whether it is something physical like that or those physical things being used as illustrations of other kinds of more serious problems that could result from things we do all the time, those dangers are out there, and there's no way that you can totally eliminate them in life. But again, the question is how you're going to respond to it. Just like you can't guarantee the king's not going to get mad at you, you can't guarantee that those kinds of disasters aren't going to happen. How are you going to respond to that? How are you going to prepare for it? Certainly, you would be foolish to go through life in this sort of happy-go-lucky way, just kind of living my life on a very surface level and thinking everything's going to be working out fine, as though things will always be the way they are now, as though you were impervious to problems. So you don't want to go that route and just be foolish and pretend like, well, it's not a big deal. This isn't going to happen to me. I'm going to be okay. I mean, how many other times have I hit a nail? It's not a problem. That would be one extreme response. But on the other extreme, here's what you could do. You could play it super safe. And some people, their personality tends this way, to be ultra safe and hide yourself and stay away from anything that involves any risk of getting hurt. That's a miserable way to live. That, according to this passage, would actually be foolish as well. And Solomon gives us two pieces of advice, and they complement each other. So look with me at verse 10 for the first word of advice. He makes a general point by using another illustration from the workaday world. He says, if the iron is blunt and one does not sharpen the edge, he must use more strength, but wisdom helps one to succeed. Or again, to quote the New American Standard Bible there at the end, wisdom has the advantage of giving success. Here, wisdom is not going to eliminate all dangers. It's not going to solve all problems. It's not going to do the work for you, eliminate all friction, eliminate anything negative that could happen. But it is going to help to protect you from many of the problems that can result from folly, of not being careful enough. And it is generally going to tend to enable you to achieve your goals. And so the point is, sharpen your axe, which is a way of saying illustratively, develop wisdom. Recognize the dangers and the obstacles that are out there and do everything within your power to become effective and to be safe and to deal with whatever may come. Don't waste your energy and your resources unnecessarily just because you're being sloppy and careless. And that speaks to the importance of preparation, of foresight, of carefulness, of getting counsel from other people and doing whatever you can do to sharpen your axe and become effective and to do things safely and successfully. You realize that today there is a whole industry that is devoted to that very thing. And it's called risk management. And I found this definition: the forecasting and evaluation, this is in the business area, the forecasting and evaluation of financial risk together with the identification of procedures to avoid or minimize their impact. What Solomon is discussing here is risk management. It is not to live life with this sort of oblivion and this shallowness that pretends as though nothing bad could happen and I'm going to automatically be successful. No, it is a cautiousness. It's demonstrating as much foresight and preparation as you possibly can. And we actually have a brother in our church who's in an office of risk management. This is what Lee Hasty does for a living. So if you want to know more about it, you can talk to him. That's about all I know. But Ecclesiastes is getting at this, and so is the Lord Jesus alluding to this when he talked in Luke chapter 14 about what? Counting the cost. He's eventually going to make a point about discipleship, but he pulls from this illustration of an individual. How are you going to put up a tower if you don't know that you're going to have enough money and the resources to actually finish this? Or a king who's going to war, how do you know that you have a decent chance of winning? You're not just going to go for it without making some kind of plan and putting some kind of strategy in place to preserve your resources and your soldiers and to be effective. Verse 11 continues along these lines, and it gets even more specific with its illustrations. This is our last verse. It gives us other analogy. And it says, if the serpent bites before it is charmed, there is no advantage to the charmer. What in the world is that talking about? Well, here again, you're facing a bit of a danger. Why anybody would have this as their profession to be a snake charmer, I don't know. I saw this video yesterday, I think, of this guy who, there was this, I shouldn't get off on that. Anyway, but I've got friends who deal with snakes. It's just like a hobby. And I'm just like, anyway, if you're in that kind of business, if the serpent bites before it is charmed, there's no advantage to the charmer. All right, so here's a highly dangerous thing to be trying to do. And it's not just about knowing how to charm and calm down the snake. It's about the timing. That if you don't do it soon enough, if you delay or if you just kind of take a casual approach and just sort of ease into it. Now, some dangers are so critical, you've got to move fast. Some things are so sensitive, you need to take action quickly or else you will suffer the consequences. This has to do not just in general with your skillfulness about life, but with the timing of carrying out your activities, particularly with those dangers in view. And it's an interesting counterpoint to what we normally tend to associate with folly, because normally when you think about something, somebody being a fool, you think, well, they move too fast. They jump in there and they don't plan, and they're just kind of reacting on a gut level and not moving carefully enough. And that's a problem. I mean, I found this verse in Proverbs 21:5. It says, "The plans of the diligent lead surely to abundance, but everyone who is hasty comes only to poverty." So if you rush into things without really having a good plan in mind, that's not the path to success. But on the other hand, this passage comes to the opposite side and says, really, sometimes the problem is you're not acting quickly enough. You're moving too slowly. You are delaying. You're waiting too much, and the danger overtakes you while you're sitting there trying to figure out what to do. If the charmer delays, the snake is going to bite us. And that illustration speaks to this, that sometimes we can be so cautious and so analytical that we end up losing an opportunity that is available for only a short window of time. And so wisdom is a bit of a complex thing, to weigh out all of these factors, to come up with some kind of approach, to know about the timing as well as my overall methods. And so how would we apply this to our lives? Well, overall, the focus is on planning and timing. And the application, I think, is wide open to whatever decisions are before you, even at this time of life, whatever area of your life that you are struggling with. These kinds of illustrations, they really do have a way. They're intended to just spark your imagination. Maybe some fascinating little slice of life for you to ponder, what's going on there and what's the point and how does that relate to my life over here? And they move you to work out the application yourself for whatever it is you're facing. So I can't really work out applications for you because I don't know what you all are dealing with or how this exactly relates to what you may be facing at this moment. However, here are some categories that I'm sure would have some bearing. I think this little passage has a lot to say to young people in terms of really appreciating the limited opportunities they have for their education. We were talking about singleness this morning and about how as life goes on and you move into other stages of life, you get so burdened down with responsibilities and you don't have the opportunities that you once had to develop your mind and to develop abilities. You're just embroiled in the minutiae of life eventually. The point would be for young people especially, throw yourself into those opportunities. They are limited. Someday you are going to regret the way you wasted your time during this season of life that was to be devoted to sharpening your axe. Sharpen your axe as much as possible. Take that seriously. What about those who are a little bit further along in life and perhaps pursuing marriage and looking for a relationship that way? I think a passage like this can be instructive to us as well, because you will often be wrestling with that issue of being careful but not putting this off forever and thinking that I will always have these opportunities or that my circumstances will always lend themselves to this or that there will always even be people around me with whom I can pursue relationships. There is a cautiousness about this, but there is also a delay that can create trouble that you may or may not be able to resolve later on. So learn by God's grace to balance between carefulness and taking appropriate initiative. We could think of a lot of other applications, financial decisions, and the importance of forecasting and budgeting versus the risk that sometimes has to be taken for the purposes of investment and long-term development. Your use of time, you recognize that there are even Ecclesiastes areas of material living that are good and that are God's provision, but you have to be strategic and cautious about how much investment you're putting here and the dangers that are there to make too much out of earthly life and neglect the more important matters of eternity and laying up treasures in heaven. We could think about ministry efforts that we're carrying out. So in the area of evangelism, for example, really seeking by God's grace to develop skill in working with people and working with individual people and the kinds of struggles and questions and objections and obstacles that they would bring to the conversation. And timing as well. There's an area where we often are very limited in the time frame of how much I will be around this person or how many opportunities I'm going to have. And I think we'd all have to confess that we're kind of like that charmer who says, well, I'll do that. I know I need to. I know it's important. Or what about other church ministries? I think this could apply and does apply not just to our individual efforts, but to our collective efforts to serve the Lord, whether in evangelism or our edification of one another or whatever it is that we're doing together as a church. We were just talking about some of these kinds of things in our leadership meeting this past Thursday. When we have a Sunday, what is the best possible use of our time? When we have all these factors that are affecting all the individuals of the church, taking all that into consideration, trying to be as wise as possible in the use of our limited times together and figuring out ways to slice out some other time or to use this opportunity effectively. This kind of thing is designed to just get your mind rolling and to seek to be as wise even as you're dealing with risk. And we'll come back to that issue of risk later in chapter 11. But as we close here, I think in all this process, we need to keep in mind the overall direction of this book and where it's going to end eventually in chapter 12 with the emphasis on fearing God. And that even as we're very much involved in this process of stewardship, we're doing so with a spirit of total reliance upon God and upon His sovereignty. That is at the heart of fearing the Lord, but again, I want to sum it up in terms of the way the New Testament would teach that spirit, where I'm striving to be a good steward with my resources and my opportunities, but I'm recognizing that there's this whole other dimension, and that I often don't know what to do. So what do I do then? Well, James 1:5 says, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. And what if I know those dangers are out there, and I'm concerned about the impact of my decisions, and what if some of my efforts fall flat on their face? And here's what James has to say as well. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit, yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. And so even while we are making the best possible effort to make wise decisions, there is this awareness, this consciousness of a sovereign God whose plan may or may not be the plan that I have for my life. And yet I move forward doing the best I can by His grace and ultimately leaving the outcome to Him. This book of Ecclesiastes will continue to encourage in us that spirit as we move on.